Welcome to another edition of Sci-Fi on Screen. My name is Jeff Palermo, and I will be your host. This is Episode 8. We're going to be talking about the Battlestar Galactica Reimagined miniseries. Not the TV show itself, but just the four-hour miniseries, or 3 hours. I'm not sure actually how long it was. That debuted in December of 2003 on the Sci-Fi Channel, when it actually used to be called the Sci-Fi Channel. When they used to play things that were vaguely science fictional. Although I shouldn't say that. They've gotten a little bit better. But for the life of me, I don't know why it's S-Y-F-Y now. Sci-Fi, as it were. Anyway, I digress. Battlestar Galactica Reimagined was created and written and basically brought to the screen by Ron Moore and a guy named David Icke, or Icke. And Moore, I'm aware of. Moore was the legend of Ron Moore, as it were. And Ron Moore was a unemployed screenwriter who was a big Star Trek fan. And while touring one of the Star Trek sets, I believe, the Star Trek Next Generation was being filmed while he was, you know, an up-and-coming young screenwriter. And he went on a tour of the set at Paramount, brought a script with him that he had written, an episode that was, you know, eventually later filmed. And while he was there, somehow he bumped into one of Gene Roddenberry's assistants. Roddenberry got the script. He must have made an impression. The woman on the set recommended an agent, which Moore then got, and the script was then sent through proper channels. They loved it, and he was hired as a writer on the show. Fuck you, Ron Moore. I'm totally kidding, but oh my God, what a jealousy-inducing story for a frustrated writer such as myself. Moore wrote for Next Generation the last few seasons, and he was sort of the next-gen Klingon expert. He wrote a lot of Klingon-themed stories and really took the Klingon mythology very seriously. When Next Gen was over, he kind of transitioned over to Deep Space Nine, where he worked for several seasons. And Deep Space Nine took on a very dark, intense tone while he was there. I am not a Deep Space Nine watcher. I can't get past the first season, so... From there, he transitioned to Voyager and then had a falling out with Brennan Braga, who was a big deal in the Trek world, sort of Roddenberry's successor in a way, and fell out. He kind of scrounged around for a while. He wrote on a show called Good vs. Evil. He wrote on a show called Carnival, which was briefly lived. And then a gentleman named David Icke called him. I don't know much about this guy. I didn't see many credits about him, but him and Moore sort of cooked up this, you know, reimagining of the series, and you can get the sort of series Bible, which Moore and him wrote online. It's fascinating. I mean, they really went deep on an old property. Brought it to the screen in December of 2003 on the Sci-Fi Channel, and the rest, as they say, is history. For this particular miniseries, I do want to point out that it was directed by a guy named Michael Reimer, who did a movie called Queen of the Damned previous to this and a movie called Perfume. I knew nothing of Michael Reimer. I don't know that I've seen anything else he's ever done, but I think the direction in this miniseries is masterful. And another note, the music was done by a guy named Richard Gibbs. And again, I think the music plays an enormous part of making this miniseries. I will state it quite plainly. I believe that this miniseries is one of the greatest pieces of filmed science fiction, space opera, ever done. There, it's been said. And they're knocking at my door already. I've got to go. So, just a brief shout out. The original Battlestar Galactica was created by Glenn A. Larson, debuted in 1978. I watched every episode, being a Star Wars fan, and loved it when I was a kid. You know, you can go back and watch it now, and you know, it does have a very well thought out universe, and there is story logic. It is cheesy as hell with lots of bad acting and bad casting, and it's very hard to take in this day and age, but it was quite a creation. And, you know, credit has to be given to Larson for coming up with the concept that allowed it to be sort of reimagined later in the century. And I think really for all that Moore and Icke did to bring it to up to date, and make it far surpass the original in every possible way. The seeds had to be there, and I think Larson created it was as well thought out enough that the premise was strong enough to hold a more modern version of itself later on, you know, and that's something to be very well respected, I think. And I think credit goes to Larson right there for his, you know, structural and thematic care that he brought. The original Galactica ran for one season, and then they quickly did Galactica 1980. Basically, Galactica finally discovers Earth. I guess the ratings were tanking. Galactica 1980 was abysmally bad. Abysmally bad. With flying bikes and, you know, Cylons coming for Halloween. It was brutal. I think only lasted like half a season. I don't know how many shows of 1980 actually made it. And then there were a couple of theatrical releases. They mashed together sort of the first two or three episodes of the original series, and then they mashed together some later episodes and released some movies in the theater of these mashups. That was it. There were, I believe, 16 or 17 novelizations also based on the Galactica world, and I think the first 12 to 11 or 12 were based off of episodes, and then I think this guy Robert Thurston ran with some original stories, and some of them are quite well written, actually. Okay, so let's get started. We start out very quietly. There are title cards that bring us up to date and kind of get us into the Galactica universe quickly. There's a lot of information that we need to digest in a fairly short period of time. I'll read the title cards after this brief explanation, but while these title cards and text are being flashed on screen, we're watching a shuttle approach a space station. And already, the visuals are already popping as the camera is mounted on the shuttle. So as it's approaching the space station and maneuvering to dock, it's very disorienting in that, you know, the shuttle seems to not move at all. All that's moving is the space around it and seemingly the space station, when actually the opposite is true. So we immediately are thrown into the fact that we are in a 360-degree, you know, spatial world. We are in space. And already up or down is relative, which I think is awesome. Inside the space station is simply a long hallway. A lone man sits there. He's looking at sheets of paper, takes out some things, looking at paper, and we see depicted on the paper the old Cylon Centurions that we know from the original series, which I think is really smart. And they do this in a lot of different places, actually, in this miniseries. They're really connecting the old with the new. And not only connecting it, they're placing the old series as part of the history of this new show, in a way. Obviously not plot-wise, because you know, none of this would have happened. But they've taken the visual look of the old film, and they've, you know, they sort of are saying that this is the history of this world. And I think that is such a smart idea. So here are the title cards. The Cylons were created by man. They were created to make life easier on the 12 colonies. And then the day came when the Cylons decided to kill their masters. After a long and bloody struggle, an armistice was declared. The Cylons left for another world to call their own. A remote space station was built where Cylon and human could meet and maintain diplomatic relations. Every year, the Colonials send an officer. The Cylons send no one. And when they put that title card up, when it says the Colonial sends an officer, we see our human being sitting at a table by himself with a briefcase. And when the card switches to the Cylon says no one, camera pans down the other end of the table and the other end of the hallway, which is completely absent. So it looks like the Cylons sort of have their own entrance to this space station. The humans have one as well. And it looks like they haven't showed up for 40 years. What a great setup. I mean, a truly amazing setup. Already the suspense is there. You know, what has happened to the Cylons? Where are they? Brilliant. And it's all done very quickly and visually. Then after this build-up, suddenly we get an entrance. And the other end of the hallway opens and two new Cylon Centurions enter. And these are sort of CGI. And they look very cool, very different than the models we know and that we saw on the gentleman's spec sheet. Very sleek, much cooler. But they've, you know, they still sport that single roving eye. They reminded me of the Emperor's red Imperial Guard, you know, that we see in the, I mean, I remember them from Return of the Jedi. They had those kind of helmets, very similar. And that roving eye is great. Brings us right back. You know, they're not changing things too much. So it's just very thrilling. However, now the new rub of this series comes into play, and an incredibly beautiful blonde woman walks in between these centurions, walks down the long hallway. She's wearing this scarlet red dress, like ridiculously, a little obviously sexy. Walks around the table, sits on the table in front of the guy, very provocative, you know, starts making out with the guy. At some point, the camera drops outside and there's this shadow that comes over the space station and we back up. We see what geek fans, as we are, must understand is the new Cylon base ships, which are sort of two huge three-pointed stars kind of stuck on each other, but offset. It's a really cool evolution of the old base ships, which were kind of, you know, two sort of saucers stuck on each other. Basically destroy the station. And what's cool is they destroy it with a missile. And it's the first inkling, again, that we are in a new world. There's no laser beams here. I mean, you know, this huge Cylon ship destroys the station with a single missile. Piqued my interest right away, like, whoa, what are they doing here? As cool as an opening as it is, it doesn't make any sense. Why would the Cylons send two of their Centurions down to the station with seemingly another Cylon, right? We're not exactly told, but we assume that it's another kind of Cylon. Just to blow up the station. It's dumb. It's just dumb. Yes, we know later on we find out that she downloads to another body, but like, why waste it? They're machines. You know, they wouldn't think that way. I don't know. It's very weird. Our prologue is done and we're into the show. We cut to space and we hear this martial Japanese drumming and these very minimalist strings. And again, the music, I think, is so important to this miniseries being what it is. You know, there's this drumming that sort of comes on and then stops, and then we hear silence. Then it comes on again and then it stops. The camera sort of approaches the Galactica in an absolute straight line. The Galactica looks really cool. It's brand new Galactica, and it's the same basic shape as the old Galactica. It's got, you know, it's kind of like an aircraft carrier in space, right? So is the original. I mean, it has those long pylons. It's almost like, it looks like an alligator, you know, with these long pylons on the side, which are very functional. You know, they're for receiving ships. Fighters land on these things. You know, shuttles come and go, and ships visiting come and go. The fighters themselves are launched out of the side of the ship. So now we're into the Galactica itself. I really like what they do here. Michael Reimer does the... I normally don't like the constantly moving and spinning camera, you know? The moving and talking camera is like an Aaron Sorkin thing. It's just annoying. However, it works in Galactica. We track Starbuck, who's played by an actress named Katie Sackhoff. And immediately, as a Galactica fan, you know, she bumps into Adama later, so you realize she's Starbuck. You're like, wow, Starbuck's a woman. Great choice. Brilliant casting, I think, and a brilliant reimagining of the character. So she's running through the Galactica. Camera is in front of her, sort of she's running towards the camera. You know, the camera is tracking back, and we're going with her. And she runs into a knot of people, and the camera stays with the people and lets Starbuck go. And then we get some exposition from a reporter who's talking to a guide, talking about the Galactica. And basically, the Galactica is being mothballed, decommissioned, turned into a museum. And it's a clever way, I think, to do it, to hear a guy talking about, you know, the history of the Galactica. And we hear that she's the last of her kind, was constructed 50 years ago during the Cylon Wars. Back then, there was one Battlestar for each colony. Galactica was Caprican Battlestar. And this is very much an homage to the original series. There were 12 Battlestars, and there was one for each colony. And we come to know now that there are like hundreds of Battlestars now in this reimagined future. From this tour group, the camera then follows sort of a random officer who peels away from the group and bumps into Commander Adama, played by Edward James Olmos. And another coup of wonderful casting. You know, he looks garrulous in his horrible skin texture. He just looks like an old leather warhorse, man. It's great. Immediately, you know, you have to do so little with him to start, you know, because he just looks so tough. And he's rehearsing a speech. And we get the first glimpse of that odd paper that they use everywhere. The paper where it's almost like they cut the corners off of it. So instead of having 4 points, there's 8 points. It's just another one of the really good touches here. Starbuck running also in her uniform, kind of her sweats. We have a female officer, female Starbuck. Now there's odd paper. You're constantly being given realistic details and also details that let us know that it's not Cleveland, like we're somewhere else. So I just think that was a really neat idea. So the camera arrives at the bridge with Adama, and we get our first little hint of plot at Lieutenant Gata. Lets Adama know Adama basically asks him any news of the day, and you get the sense that, you know, there hasn't been war for 40 years. The Cylons are gone. They're decommissioning the Galactica. Like, nobody has even a glimpse or a glimmer of anything. Like, they're all warriors with no war, in a way. You know, Gator's like, no, not really. And then, oh, yeah, there's this one thing, you know, a diplomat's overdue from, you know, his assignment. So, obviously, that's a diplomat we saw destroyed. So there's a first hint that something's up. And then we follow Felix Gaeta with the camera, and we see Colonel Ty standing off, kind of leaning against a bulkhead, and we get a sense that he's drinking, although he's ostensibly holding a coffee cup. Ty is played by an actor named Michael Hogan. So from Ty, we peel back off to the reporter talking about Galactica and how it lacks an interesting thing. It lacks networked computers. And he's talking about it in a quasi-joking way. Like, we would talk about sort of like, oh, we had phones with cords, kind of, you know. And they're talking about that back then, the Cylons could infiltrate computer networks with ease. And so there was a lack of network computers. So you get the sense, and it's not really spelled out, but you get a sense that that anachronism has been abandoned by the newer ships. But we don't really know that yet. We're back with Adama, and he enters the flight deck. As he enters the flight deck, from behind him, we get a glimpse of our first glimpse of the modern Viper, which is called the Mark 7. And it looks really, really cool. I mean, they really designed the hell out of this show. Everything looks so well designed and just sleek and futuristic and functional as well. Very souped up from the old Vipers that we used to see on the TV show. The production design of the older of the show is sort of being positioned as 50 years ago. And it's damn clever, you know? I think it's like 30 years or maybe more, but it's a damn clever thing because we get to have our cake and eat it too. I think so rare is the reimagined show that can do this. I think it's a terrific, terrific choice. The deck crew, you know, everyone's pretty much, I think once they decommission the ship, they're all going their separate ways. So, you know, people are saying goodbye to each other, and the deck crew gives Adama this plaque, and they have reconditioned one of his old Vipers. And so they pull the sheet off of the ship, and it's the old, and it looks very close to the old Vipers that we know from the show. They redesigned it a little bit, so it looks a little bit different, but very cool looking. And we realize that they're called the Mark II Viper. And then the Mark 7s are the new ones, so obviously there's been different models of Viper. But the Mark 2s are like the Galactica. They don't have networked computers. The Mark 7s do. And it's notable that Chief Tyrell is the main, sort of the chief of the deck, and he's played by this guy named Aaron Douglas, and he's a terrific actor. I mean, roots you in the deck crew, and really, I don't know, it's just something about his performance is just incredible. I find him a marvelous actor. And there's a brief moment when they unwrap this plaque that they found, you know, like somewhere in the bowels of the ship. And it's an old photograph of Adama when he was a young man. And we see that he has two young sons next to him. So it's the first inkling at Adama's character as well, that he has two sons. Original series aficionados will realize that, you know, will there still be an Apollo and a Zach? And, you know, what have they done with that relationship? So after this, we cut to a poker game. Colonel Ty is there. Starbuck is there. We meet Boomer, who is also female and Asian. And we meet Hilo. We realize that there's an animosity between Starbuck and Colonel Ty. You know, he's drunk. They're playing cards. And truth be told, Starbuck's kind of a dick. I mean, she's a dick. She's cocky. She's arrogant. You know, she's not a very likable character. Smoking a cigar, very irreverent. You know, they're trading barbs, and she's like, how's the wife, Ty? And obviously things are not going well, and he's asking her how she got her nickname, and you can tell they just don't like each other. And during this time, they do this thing with the spinning camera, and so, but they write it that way. So they have the camera spinning, like you're looking at Starbuck, and then it spins to Boomer, and Boomer happens to have a line. Spins to Hilo, he has a line. Spins to Ty, he has a line, and so on and so forth. So it's not just purely for show. Like, they wrote it for the tracking camera, and I like it. I mean, they don't overuse it to death. They do use it a lot in this show, but you can tell that they knew they wanted to do that, and they structured the writing to match it, and I think that's neat. It's not pure technique, you know. It's integrated into the concept of the visual concept of the show. So Starbuck wins the hand. Ty somehow, just like he's in a bad mood, he smashes the table and knocks it over, and Starbuck punches him right in the face. Ty's like, I got you now, you know, head into the brig. And she's just a, I like that they made Starbucks. She's just a fuck up. Like, she is just some jerkwad fuck up, you know, and she's like smiling as she's going to the brig. And it's a terrific role because the essence of Starbuck, the original character, was this character. It's just, it's 1978 TV, so he can't be too much of a dick. And again, the fact that they made it a woman and she's the best pilot in the fleet, it's terrific. Then there's a brief scene in Adama's quarters. He's basically talking Ty out of pressing charges, telling him, look, you were drunk. You did knock over the table first. I know she's a fuck up, but go easy on her. She's the best Viper pilot who ever lived. You know, better than him, better than Ty. And so you're getting a hint that, and then Ty's like, you really, you know, have a soft spot for her. So you get a sense that there's some connection between the two, although you don't know yet what that is. So then we visit for the first time Caprica City on Caprica. We meet the Secretary of Education at this point, Laura Roslin, played by Mary McDonnell, who's phenomenal. Another solid casting. There has been no casting missteps since this thing started. You know, each principal is just was so well cast. She's waiting for her doctor. There's a little Easter egg here. The camera starts looking through the glass ceiling overhead, and we see ships flying overhead. And the people who did the special effects for Galactica were the people who did the special effects for Firefly. And I'm told, because I have not seen Firefly, I don't know much about it, that the ship flying over that doctor's office at that point was a Firefly class ship. I guess Firefly geeks will have to go check it out. I have no idea, but I thought I would just drop that little info in there. But it's very realistic looking. Anyway, you see smoke coming out, you know, more and more. The shots of the ships, everything is very natural. Like, it's not a space, quote, it's not Star Trek. What it's, you know what I mean? I mean, I've seen Firefly. Firefly is definitely a step up in terms of sci-fi visuals. It's a beautifully photographed show. And this is very much in this Firefly vein. It is not Trek. It's not pretty. It's not plasticky. You know, like, there's a realism, a sense of realism here that's new to sci-fi television, I think. Roslin finds out she has cancer. And then we track to the government ship that she's on, and she's on her way to Galactica. And we get our first taste of the way they're going to film space flight in this show. And they do it in a way where they make, you know, you hear the sounds of ships, but it's not very noisy. Like, they're very respectful of the silence of space. And more than that, and we'll get to that later, they're respectful of the physics of space. So a lot of times when you see ships running or moving, like, it's completely silent, and it's a great effect. And what they also do is they'll track a ship from a bit away, and then they'll do like a quick zoom. And it's a little bit steadicam-ish, so it's a little shaky. And then they'll do a quick zoom in. And the whole thing, it's a little herky-jerky. And I think, again, I've never seen sci-fi space opera shot like this. You know, space opera's a shot, even Star Wars, there's a classicism to a lot of science fiction space movies where everything's in the frame, and, you know, and this is off kilter and kind of crazy, and it's great. I think it's, again, it brings me into the show in such an incredibly intimate way. Then we have this really creepy scene. We see a woman who is identical to the woman who blew up in the space station, walking through like an open air market on Caprica City. And she's having this conversation with this woman, this mother, and there's a newborn baby or very young infant in a stroller. And they're talking about, oh, so fragile, whatever. And when the woman looks away, Six, as this Cylon model is called, leans down and like crushes its windpipe. It's a creepy, kind of sick thing. Again, I think it works, you know? You know so little at this point in the show that you're just, you know, you're being thrown left and right by the visuals, by the actors, and then this incredible trick. And, you know, it really gives the Cylons a sinister edge. You're like, who, what the hell, you know, is this all about? And it's awesome. And then we meet Baltar in another casting coup. His name is Gaius Baltar. I don't know if Baltar had a first name in the original series. I think he was just Baltar. He's playing by this actor named James Callis, and he's this vain sort of Epicurean. He's supposed to be the smartest man in the 12 colonies. He's a genius, and he's dating this blonde Cylon. It's all about, they're, you know, ripping each other's clothes off, and they begin to have sex, and we see her spine glow red from behind her, and it's a really weird scene. So now we cut back to the Galactica. Apollo's Viper is approaching. We're getting that altered vocal effect that we got. It's like sort of vocal redshift that we got so well in episode 4 of Star Wars A New Hope. And it's really cool. Again, you know, very much a realistic effect. And again, we get a sense of what's going to happen here during space flight. And we see Apollo's Viper operating. It's very realistic, the way spacecraft operate in space. I mean, just to digress a little bit about space physics, right? If you were in the middle of deep space and you threw a baseball, that baseball would not stop traveling until it impacted another object. There's absolutely nothing in space to slow it down. All of the ships that we see in science fiction, almost all of them are incorrect, except when you get a film like 2001, which tries to adhere to physics. Having wings in spaceships, having intake in spaceships. I mean, the Vipers have these, what looks like jet intakes. That would only work in atmosphere. So when you're in deep space, like, there's no air to act on any kind of a winged surface. So there's no banking and rolling and turning. If you can do all that stuff, but it all has to be done by attitude jets. I mean, just think about it. If you were sort of in deep water, just buoyant, right? I mean, any move you made, you would have to sort of have a little something. You'd have to be holding something in your hand that you could press and it would push you. And depending on how you held that device, it would push you and move you in certain ways. And this is how astronauts operate in orbit. They use that jetpack that they strap on, and it's covered with, you know, dozens of little attitude jets. And even though the astronaut has a joystick, it's all computer wired to, if you joystick left, you know, it's just certain things that are firing. They're doing this in Galactica. I mean, this is how the physics of the spacecraft work. And it's amazing. It's an amazing shot as the camera approaches. We see Apollo coming into the Galactica. And another interesting effect is that Apollo is waiting to be guided into the landing bay by some sort of automatic guidance system, which we're assuming is what's state-of-the-art now on the modern Battlestars, that, you know, you let go of the controls, the Battlestar takes control of your Viper, guides you in. But of course, they say, you know, Apollo, call the ball. And call the ball is a modern aircraft carrier pilot term. When the pilot's ready to land, they tell the pilot of the jet, you know, on the aircraft carriers, call the ball. And he's, of course, surprised, like, call the ball? You know, modern. So it's just a great, again, another great, very realistic way to open up a scene. Then when Apollo lands, we get our first look at the Galactica's flight deck. Very realistic looking. A lot of people in orange jumpsuits, which just really reminded me of shots of documentaries, flight decks of aircraft carriers. And then we get close to another type of ship. Basically, the two types of small ships in the show are the Vipers, which are the fighters, and the Raptors. And Raptors are sort of radar ships. Of course, radar in Galactica is called Dratus. It has a different name, possibly a different function. And a Raptor is a ship, which I'll get into a little later, how it functions with a squadron, sort of like an AWACS electronic warfare plane, like a big 757 jet that they send up in the air really high to vector in the fighters. But it's a very small ship. But we get a camera close to the ship, and we see stenciled on the front, you know, don't stand here, this way up, like all the, again, all the stenciling that you see on modern military jets. They just put it right on there. And you know, these disheveled mechanics in orange jumpsuits running around. It's very realistic looking. And for a TV show, very gritty, and it's great. So then we meet Boomer fully. We met Boomer before during the card game. Now we meet her fully. She's a Raptor pilot. Crew Chief Tyrol and her start arguing about a ship. The camera tracks them as they go. They continue to argue and walk away, and they end up in sort of a storeroom, and Tyrol slams the door, and they start disrobing, and you realize that the argument was kind of a bit of a sham to get them away from the group, and they attack each other with intense lust. So we're introduced to the Boomer-Tyrol relationship. Then a brief bit of Apollo character building. There's the CAG roll call. And Apollo's sitting in the audience with the other Viper pilots. The CAG, obviously, is a huge Adama fan. And he's saying, you know, we have Apollo. He's going to... Basically, they want Apollo to fly in his father's old Viper during sort of the decommissioning ceremonies. And Apollo could give a shit. And you're getting a sense now even more that there's really something between the father and son. So it's a nice little tick off to where this is going. So then we get our first instance of religion in Galactica. And Galactica, the series, will contain a lot of religion. There's lots of subplots based on religion and belief. And it begins, and it comes from the Cylons, actually. You get Baltar and Six are walking down a crowded city street. You get a sense that Six believes in God. So God told me to find you. God told me this. God told me that. And Baltar, of course, is very hip and modern and skeptical and so on and so forth. You don't really know what's happening here between them. But once Baltar leaves and she's by herself, she looks sort of straight at the camera and said, you know, it's about time you got here. I've been waiting. And it's a very ominous moment. And then in a nice little visual pun, we cut to an original 1979 Cylon, which is now in a museum glass case, which is sort of a visual gag. Obviously, you know, we just came from a Cylon talking to what we assume is another Cylon. And now we cut to the old Cylon in a case. And the camera pans around and we're in the museum on the Galactica. And there's a model of the old base star, which basically was two kind of conical sections touching at the tips. And nice for old fans again, you know. And I remember those models that that came out around the time of Galactica, which I never got the base star on the model, but I do, you know, we all remember what they look like. And now we come to another part of this miniseries, which I think is so amazing. And it comes from the arrival of Laura Roslin. So Roslin arrives with her aide Billy, I can't pronounce his last name. Anyway, they're on the ship, and Billy gets separated from Laura, and he winds up opening a door to what looks like a crew and pilot bathroom. Basically, what we see in this bathroom are men and women at shaving, showering, going about their business in various states of undress. There's the beginnings of a little romance. Billy meets this female bridge officer, and she's in there like basically in a sports bra, and she's like, you know, shut the door, get in or get out. And it's all very matter of fact. So what the writer and the director here are doing is they're not commenting. They're not making a big show of like, look, men and women are doing things together that, you know, normally they don't do. Isn't this cool? They just do it. It's just in the show, in the theme. And you know, as the show goes on, I don't know how much more of it is in the miniseries, but as the show goes on, you know, men and women, it's all co-ed, bathrooms, showers, everything, and especially in the military. You know, the military is completely integrated, and there's just no commenting on it. It's completely taken. It kind of reminded me, again, of Cameron's Aliens, you know, where you had men and women mixing, trash-talking in various states of undress, and there was just no prurience, no, you know, no, like, heightening of stuff. And I found that very mature and, my God, so welcome to, you know, because I think it's important that that possibility or that idea be visualized. So, you know, people can look up at the screen and see a social setting that is being thought of and put on the screen. And they think, hey, it's, you know, actually, when you think about it, it isn't a fucking big deal. And, you know, what would stand in the way of us doing that? So, I don't know, a little side digression there, but again, another part of the show which I find refreshingly mature and adult. And as I'm growing older, I like my sci-fi to grow with me. And in this miniseries, for sure, it does. Then we get our first meeting between Adama and Laura Roslin. And this will, you know, these are the two big principles that last throughout the entire series. The ship is being decommissioned, it's being turned into a museum. Roslin will probably run it. And there'll be a lot of teaching on the Galactica. So she's telling Adama, you know, she needs her techs to install a networked computer system. And of course, you know, this is Adama, right? The ship's being decommissioned. He's retiring probably. I mean, they're all being cashiered out of the service. I mean, the Galactica really is like, you know, it's where all the fuck-ups land. People like Starbuck. It's sort of like the rat trap of the fleet. It's 20 years old. But of course, he's like, I will not have network computers on this ship while I'm commander. And, you know, you get the sense that Roslin basically will have to go to the president and say, would you get this asshole off the ship, please? But as we are to see very soon, and wonderful storytelling, Adama's stubbornness saves. So then we cut to the brig, and Starbuck is in the brig for slugging Colonel Ty. And she's in there doing push-ups, you know, in tough girl Starbuck manner. Apollo, basically his name is Lee Adama, but his call sign is Apollo. I guess I'll refer to him as Apollo since, you know, I'm kind of a geeky fan. we get some back and forth from them. We see this is a contentious relationship, and it's done really well, you know. And what the information we're given is that her and Zach, which was Apollo's now dead younger brother, were in a relationship. The death of Zach really, really sundered this whole trio. It's sundered the relationship between Adama and Apollo. It's sundered, you know, Apollo basically hasn't seen any of them since Zach died. He basically vanished. And so there's this moment when then Starbuck becomes very human. From this tough girl asshole, now we get a glimpse of her humanity. She drops the sarcasm, and she really wants to connect with Lee about Zach. And, you know, she tells him that the old man really, you know, misses him, so on and so forth. So it really deepens Starbuck's character to not just have her be the jackass. Like, she turns here, and then when Lee kind of doesn't want to deal with it, she gets angry again. And again, she... it's a quick rounding of Starbuck, and you get the sense that she's going to be a real pivotal character in this show, which she becomes. So now you get the confrontation between Apollo and his father. They're both in dress uniform, and there's this great moment where they, you know, they have to pose for photographs, and, you know, they greet each other in military formality, and they stand like foot away from each other, and the photographer's having to tell him, guys, get a little closer, you know, Apollo, why don't you put your arm around your father? And you can tell it's just so strained. It's a very clever bit of writing and directing to show the contentiousness between the characters in this way, rather than hitting it on the nose. I think it's very, very clever. So everyone leaves. Of course, Adama asks Lee to stay, and he's anxious to connect with his son. But for some reason, Apollo just will not have it, and he just wants to go. And then what we learn here is that Apollo really, really believes that Adama was sort of this father who was like, you're not a man unless you're a Viper pilot. And he's coming from this place of like, you manipulated your son into wanting your affections. And the only way he could get your affections was by becoming a Viper pilot. And you pulled strings to get him there. You get a sense that Apollo's kind of blaming Adama for his death, you know, in two ways. Number one, in withholding his sort of love until he was a military man. And number two, and then making that thing happen when from Apollo's point of view, it wasn't really in him to do that, you know. And this is great family dynamics, as opposed to, you know, an earlier podcast, I talked about War of the Worlds, where there was a family dynamic of three characters. None of it made sense. It was all designed to make you on the edge of your seat. All of this makes sense. And it probably reaches people in the audience that have gone through similar things with their parents. And it's great. It's real. It's trying to get at real dynamics. It's not just being done cynically on the page like, well, we have to have a schismed family for drama. Like, as a viewer, I'm watching this and I'm like, yeah, this is good. And it ends very intensely. Like, Apollo basically says, you killed him, Dad. You killed him. And he's just so angry. And his words are like daggers. And Adama is like, you're dismissed, you know. And it's a very intense scene, very good scene. So now we cut back to Caprica. And we're in a scene with Baltar and Six. Six walks in on Baltar in the morning of this new day on Caprica. He's with another woman. She seems angry. And, you know, we initially think it's because he's cheating on her. And Gaius is just, you know, such an incredibly weak, shifty, scummy character, let's face it. So then she proceeds to sit him down, and we cut back and forth. This scene gets cut up between some other scenes, but ostensibly she sits down and says, I'm a Cylon, we look like this now, you know, so on and so forth. So when we catch up with them again, he's still trying to digest, after they kicked that other woman out, that she's a Cylon. And he's like, I'm having a hard time believing that since the last time anyone saw a Cylon, they look like toasters. And she said, those models still have their uses. And then she starts talking about all the poking around in the defense mainframe. And we get a sense that Baltar is a computer genius and that he's responsible for a lot of the software that runs the entire Galactica fleet. She helped him with a lot of the stuff, but also we are starting to recognize that, you know, she basically sabotaged the entire fleet's defense system. He goes into ass covering mode, and we see as soon as he digests it, the first one, it's like, I had nothing to do with this. And it's classic Baltar, which, you know, this character will. He'll gall after a while of the show. I have to say, this character does tend to gall some at times, but goes into ass covering mode. And then Six tells him, you know, look, you don't have to worry about anything because it's all over. Because Baltar's like, they'll kill me, they'll put me on trial. And then the scene ends with the glare of a nuclear explosion in the distance. We cut briefly back to Galactica, and they're having the decommissioning ceremony. And the nice little Easter egg here is that they're playing the old soundtrack music from the TV show in the background. It's very quick. Blink and you'll miss it. Adama makes this incredible speech. I mean, it's a really great speech. He starts off talking the speech that he was working on when we first met him in the beginning of the show. But Apollo's comments have shattered him. And in the middle of it, there's this great subtextual speech. I mean, it purports to be about the humans and their relationship to the Cylons, that the human race sort of created the Cylons and bred them for a certain purpose. And then, you know, the Cylons kind of rebelled and went a different way. And in a sense, Adama gave birth to Zach and was responsible for Zach and sort of, you know, wanted Zach to go in a certain way and, you know, blew up in his face. And basically, he kind of comes apart. He doesn't cry or anything, but he's really raw and rag-assed. The great thing is because of the Apollo, because we've gotten background on their relationship or Adama and Zach's relationship, we understand the subtext of the speech, and it's just another beautiful bit of writing. Really, really is. And at the same time, Adam is admitting publicly that he fucked up, that he really fucked up, and he's finally beginning to learn to take responsibility in his heart, because what some of what Apollo said was true. And because Apollo is doing the flyby and the Viper and his comm system is on, we see Apollo's reaction to what his father's saying. And we get a sense that he feels maybe bad, that, you know, now he feels pity for the old man and maybe he might be ready to set aside sort of his anger because his old man seems to be, you know, stepping up. It's a beautifully subtle little scene. And again, this show is all about the continual showing of subtle touches of character, subtle touches of the world we're looking at, subtle touches of how things work. And it all builds. And that's what, you know, you don't have to do a lot of big stuff, I think, visually in the visual medium. You continue to accumulate the quality of a lot of small things, you know, that you really take care in the details of how you're presenting something to an audience. You don't need to go big. You can stay dramatically sort of coherent and focus on making the little things in every level of the visual presentation as good as you can get, and the rest will take care of itself. And I think this miniseries is a brilliant example of that. So then briefly we cut back to Baltar, and he's watching the bombs drop in the distance. We're getting a sense now, he's like, well, you know, of course you're not going to destroy the world, he tells Six, because you'll die. And we get the first bit of information about the Cylons' supposed immortality. And she's telling us that, you know, my body will be destroyed, but I'll just be downloaded into another body at another location, that I'm pretty much immortal. We also are getting the information now that there are 12 Cylon humanoid models, and that she's number 6. It's that first bit of information on where we're going to go plot-wise here. The sequence ends with the camera out in space. The nuclear bombs are just dropping like maybugs on Caprica, and you see it from space, and it's a chilling and beautiful shot. So then we're back on Galactica. Adama gets the call, the Cylon attack, and it's great because it's like Pearl Harbor. Like, everyone thinks it's a joke. Ty's like, it's a joke. They're having fun with you, buddy. But Adama, I guess, receives some other knowledge and knows that it's actually more real than anything else. He gets Starbuck out of the bridge. Starbuck's name, by the way, is Kara Thrace. They don't have any bullets, so there's not much munitions on the Galactica. I believe there's bullets for the Vipers, but the ship itself doesn't have much. But what Kara does is she gets all the pilots, and they go, you know, kind of demolish the museum. And they take all the old Mark II Vipers that were there. Crew Chief Tyrol is basically given the task to get these ships up and running and to get the reactors supposedly fitted out and charged up. So off they go. So now we cut to Rosalyn had left the Galactica on her ship heading back to Caprica, and she was escorted by the Galactica's entire fleet of Mark VII Vipers. They were all with her, plus one Raptor. And now we get our first full-on space battle. The way this starts out is that the Raptor, again, functions like the AWACS or other electronic surveillance craft and vectors the fighters in. So it discovers several Cylons near Caprica, and it backs way off, and the Vipers sort of head in. Then we see the drums start. Like, whenever they have battles, these great Japanese drums start. Drums for battles, I think it's a great thing. Because we're not told how to feel. You know, we're not given these John Williams-esque sort of emotional cues. And once in a while, you know, when necessary, but for the most part, it's just, you know, the drumming is very intense and it's dark. And I think it's a terrific idea. So basically, we get our first reveal of the Cylon Raiders. There are no cockpits. They're basically flying helmets, these huge, you know, it's like two scimitars kind of side by side with this big helmet in the middle. They realize that, you know, the Cylons have engineered basically the ships are sentient. And another really cool idea. And we see the center eye sort of the ships open up, and there's this little emission of red light. And all of a sudden, all of the Vipers lose power. They're out of control. And what's great is, for whatever reason, they lost power and they start to kind of tumble into one another because nothing's guiding them. And there's this great moment when the CAG's Viper smashed into by another Viper because basically, I guess when they lost power, several Vipers were in the middle of a maneuver, so everyone's kind of tumbling end over end, you know, out of control. And again, it's space, so it's done really well. So, however, then the Cylons launch, the two Cylon ships launch a very numerous salvo of missiles and basically annihilate the Vipers and kind of fly past. Like, it's such a badass moment for the Cylons. Basically, like, they knock out the ships and they destroy them all and they fly on with, like, not a scratch. So Boomer and Hilo are in the Raptor. They basically are trapped. You know, they're going to try to get to Caprica to search for survivors. But before they can figure out what to do next, a Cylon, you know, one of the Cylons basically launches a missile at the Raptor. And then both the Cylons kind of turn around and take off. Like, it's sort of like what they call a fire and forget weapon. The Raptor outruns the missile, but a piece of shrapnel from the exploding missile sort of punctures the ship. And it's a really cool scene because, you know, again, in many films and TV shows, like, ships are in space, they're fighting, and it's over. And this one, a piece of shrapnel actually punctures the deck. So we get a leak in the ship. We see Boomer pull out these little round sort of patches, the little round pieces of rubber with handles on them. And she sticks it over the deck, like, seals the rent in the deck. And again, it's very realistic. It's very nuts and bolts of, like, what you would do to combat against hull punctures from shrapnel or bullets. Because, you know, there are no lasers here, just missiles and bullets. It's another example of that subtle realism that just is hitting you over and over and over again from a dozen different angles. It's amazing. However, the shrapnel has damaged the Raptor, and they need to get to Caprica. And so Boomer sort of, again, uses the technique which utilizes space physics. And she will sort of set out for Caprica and then shut down all the power in the ship and sort of glide in, sort of a little Han Solo Empire Strikes Back skullduggery, as it were. So they wind up landing on Caprica. So let me cut back to this colonial sort of diplomatic passenger liner. And Rosalyn is sort of, the people on the liner are coming to understand that the attack is real. I mean, that the Cylon attack now is everywhere. All the planets are being hit. Pretty much every colony is being nuked. Like, it's real apocalypse stuff here. And Rosalyn shows her grit early. And she starts taking command of the vessel. You know, let's clear out this bay for storage. What are we going to do about food? We need to look for survivors. It's really a great way of getting to know how this, you know, Secretary of Education, who's like, you know, 13th in line from the president, or maybe even longer, maybe he's like 26th or something, has a natural gravity about her and has some grit to her. So the ship is discovered by the Cylons. They launch a missile at it. Apollo, then, who's escorting them, because he was in a Mark II Viper, I guess he was the last of... It's not really clear, actually. All the other Galactica Vipers are doing near Caprica, so far away from Galactica. And I thought they were all escorting Rosalyn. But actually, I think only Apollo was. Perhaps the Vipers were sort of either on maneuvers or on patrol or launched to intercept the Cylons purposefully. So I guess that's a little vague in the show, actually. We are now at the point of view of the missile, right? So the camera is the missile heading towards Rosalyn's ship, and all of a sudden, you know, Apollo, his ship drops right in front of it and becomes the heat source, as it were. Most of these kind of missiles are infrared, and he turns away from Rosalyn's ship. The missile follows him, and again, we're using, you know, the physics of space. So Apollo is traveling a certain speed ahead of the missile, but his ship completely pivots on his axis and fires back along the route it's come, and it loses no speed this way because nothing's slowing it down, and destroys the missile, but it's a nuke, and so the shockwave kind of renders his Viper inoperable, and he has to get picked up by Rosalind's ship. So now the Galactica goes into action, and we have the first instance of the Galactica at war. And basically, the older Vipers are shooting off into space. Something's wrong with Kara's, so she's kind of held back initially from the fight. The older Vipers sort of, you know, engage with some Cylons, and somehow the Cylon jamming technique, which has rendered all the Mark 7s inoperable, does not work on the old Mark 2s. The catapult launch of the Vipers coming out is straight out of the old show. You're right in front of the Viper as it's shooting down a catapult, and then as it goes by you, the camera sort of pivots to the right, and it's right out of the old show. It's another great thing. So the battle is amazing, and it's all about, there's no lasers, you know, it's missiles and bullets, basically. You know, they're finally making some way against the Cylons. Like, the human pilots are pretty amazing. And we have this great tension as Kara's ship has to be, you know, just repaired. And finally, she gets into the fight, and she's an unbelievable pilot. You know, she's flipping the ship around left and right, blowing up Cylons. Katie Sackhoff, man, this was the casting here was perfect. She's awake and alive in that cockpit, and she doesn't have to do much. You know, they give her great lines, and but she's fantastic, and she kicks ass. And actually, the humans do pretty well against the Cylons. However, one Cylon you see from a close-up shot is carrying nukes, and it gets off three of them before it gets destroyed. Kara follows them in. She's able to destroy two of them, but not the third. It impacts on Galactica. And you get a sense that, you know, the ship had plenty of shielding, so most of the hard stuff was kept away, but there are these massive fires now raging along one of the landing bays. And Adama puts Ty in charge. And again, this is this great scene of the casualties and the consequences of real war. You know, we're not back in, you know, we're not in a place, in a science fictional place where there are no consequences. And we're reminded of this over and over again by this amazing show. So there are about 80 of Tyrell's men trapped by the fire. And Tyrell says, look, I need, you know, another 40 seconds and I can do this thing, which will save them. And Ty realizes that the fire is so close to the fuel lines that power the ship that if it gets there, they'll lose the ship. So he makes this call to put the bulkheads down and vent the entire area to space and instantly putting out the fires, which, again, great physics, right? And if there were such a thing as big ships like this in space, they would have these things where, you know, the minute oxygen is taken from a fire, it's out. He makes the call to do it, you know, and it's an intense scene because these people haven't been in battle for most of their lives. They've just trained and drilled, but they've never actually had to go into battle. And Ty makes the tough call. And you get, he doesn't want to make the call. He keeps looking back to Adama, you know, and Adama's like, he put Ty in charge. And so Ty has to step up and make the call. And it's a great scene because it's these, you know, these guys die, most of them die. And in the way it's shot, again, you see these bodies kind of floating out of the area that was affected, and it's very chilling. So the next sequence, we're back on Caprica with Boomer and Hilo. Basically, an entire crowd of refugees comes and surrounds the ship, and they're keeping them back with weapons. They finally agree to take all the children, and they realize they can take like six adults. And so they have this lottery. You know, they rip out pieces of the manual and you know, their people are giving their numbers and coming on board. Hilo sees Baltar out in the crowd and he goes up to Baltar. You know, Baltar's in the midst of like looking at a woman who can't read her number and it's actually a winning number. And so there's a pause and you think, you know, is Baltar going to take her number and give her his and like get on? But before he has a chance, Hilo is like, aren't you guys Baltar? And he's like, I haven't done anything. She has the winning number. You know, he's so paranoid that anyone's going to figure out that he was involved in basically the death of his race. Hilo, in a wonderful scene, goes back to Boomer and is like, look, this is one of the greatest minds of our time. You know, tell me why he shouldn't be on this ship and I should. And Boomer's like, no, you have to come. He gives up a seat for Baltar. You know, it's a very poignant scene. We get some wonderful music in. We get Boomer lifting off and we see Hilo is basically left behind with the rest of the refugees on Caprica to fend for himself. And it gets kind of real. One of the refugees doesn't want to be left behind. So as Boomer's lifting off, he jumps on the wing and Hilo has to kill him. You know, he shoots him off the wing. and away it goes. And again, we're getting a lot of hard calls here. We're getting, the humans are getting beat badly, and it's being shown dramatically in a lot of different ways. And the writing, this is probably the greatest thing Ron Moore will ever write. Quickly back aboard Rosalind's ship, we get this wonderful sequence where she's sending messages to the government. There's no answer but an automated message. And so Rosalind sends her ID kind of back along the message, and she gets this automatic printout, which basically tells her that she's it. Like the president, I mean, just think about it. If it would have been as if, the U.S. Secretary of Education was on a trip somewhere, aliens invaded and destroyed Washington, like everyone is gone. And the way it's dramatized in the show is really chilling. And Rosalind is just in shock. So she's sworn in as the president. She's the new president of the colonies. Quickly back to Galactica, Crew Chief Tyrell sort of comes to Adama, and he's like, that son of a bitch killed 80 of my men. And Adama basically brushes him back and is like, he made a tough call. I would have done the same thing. Get back to your duties, chief. Watch what you're saying. And it's the first time any of them, well, not Adama, but it's the first time the younger people have been in action, and they don't know how to react to it. And Adama's basically like, get your ass back in line. This is war, sonny. It's a great scene. As Rosalind takes control of the government, Adama realizes that, the main players in the colonial fleet are all dead. He takes control. Then they have this first tug of war between them. Rosalind wants to stay out in space in her ship and look for survivors. And Adama is like, get the ship, all the faster than light ships back here. We have to hide you. And then Galactica has to get back into the fight. They're looking for bullets and looking for places where they can find munitions so they can kind of get the ship ready and get back into the battle. And Rosalind is adamant. She's like, no, you come to me because you have to help in rescue operations. And of course, it doesn't play out quite yet, because at that moment, Cylons discover Colonial One. There's no more Viper. We see Apollo run down into the belly of the ship. There are these sort of electric pulse generators that, were sort of name-checked earlier in the episode. He's running down to do something with them. And then we're only from Galactica's point of view. They're tracking the Cylon, Rosalind's ship, and from their point of view, it looks as if the Cylons have obliterated the ship and Adama has lost his second son. And with that, we end the first half of the miniseries. So I'm going to do this in two parts, since it's pretty long. It's a four-hour miniseries, so I'm going to end here, and I'll say this is the end of part one of the Battlestar Galactica miniseries show. And I hope you enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun making it, as I always do. You can find us online at scifionscreen.com. You can find us on iTunes. You can find us on Facebook. We're standing outside your house right now. I would love your feedback about the show, about specific movies. If you're out there and you like what I'm doing, drop a line. You don't like what I'm doing, drop a line, and I'll also listen. You can contact us at scifionscreen@gmail.com. See you next time, and thanks for listening.